Okay, so thank you. I'm sorry, but I will switch to something complete, well, which might look completely different first. There have been a lot of talk, especially last week during the conference, about plasticity of amorphous material or granular media. And yeah, I will try to speak about plasticity in crystalline materials and discuss how it can be sometimes intermittent and sometimes not, depending on the crystal symmetry. And this work has been done with several students and colleagues, including Lev, who is here. So on the theoretical part, maybe he will be able to answer better than I can. So just to start, when you look at classical textbook for a first-year student about plasticity, you can see this kind of stress-strain curve where you have elastic loading and then yield stress, and you may have stage one plasticity and then possibly some strain hardening. But in any case, the curve looks like quite smooth. And so in fact, generally, people consider the classical view of plastic flow, that's why it's called flow, it's that plasticity is smooth and homogeneous. So finally, it means that fluctuations are assumed to be mild. And by this term mild, I mean that all the moments of the distribution are finite. But actually, it is known for a very long time that at least for some materials and for some loading conditions, plasticity can be quite jerky. And this is a very old work of Orwan on zinc single crystals. So zinc has an hexagonal structure, and where you can see steps of deformation. And Orwan already spoke about dislocation, avalanches of dislocation at that time. But they didn't try to look at the distribution of avalanche size and so on. And so more recently, and now it's quite old work for me, but we performed experiment on ice single crystals, putting acoustic emission transducer on the face of the crystal, and we recorded the signal emitted during dislocation avalanches.
How large is that?
It's like it's 10 centimeter and something like that.
This, this is a centipillar.
Yeah,
it's a micropillar.
No, it's yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's a single crystal. So ice has an hexagonal structure. So it, as you will see, it's quite important to what's happened. And the good point also with ice is that if you have any kind of micro crack occurring, it reflected very well the light. So you can immediately detect that you have some micro cracking. And so if you have not, as in this experiment, you can be sure that it acoustic emission is not related to micro cracking or damage.
Great question. So yeah. There is no polycrystallinity in this?
No, not this one. Yeah.
Single crystal?
Yeah, it's a single crystal. Yeah. And the dislocation density at the beginning, it's very low. It's something like 10 to the power 8. Whereas, for example, typical dislocation density in metals, it's order of magnitude larger. So,
what is it about ice that lets it be that low? What's special about ice?
It's also the way we are preparing it. I mean, it takes about 1 month to grow a crystal like that. So it's quite cheap, but it's not cheap in terms of manpower. It's cheap in terms of material. But
and why is it that you can hear the crackling so much better than everyone else?
Well, I think that for ice, at least, the good point is that you can freeze the transducer directly to the to the crystal. So the coupling is really good. So then I will also present results obtained on different metals. And generally, in this case, you have to couple the transducer with some grease or something like that. So the coupling is not as good. So, Okay, so that was the kind of crackling capacity we obtained. So here is the square root of the acoustic energy through time. So we just applied a constant load on the sample. So it's what I call creep deformation. But the good thing is that with this kind of loading, you do not emit mechanical noise related to the machine. And so this is the kind of signal you have. And if you look, if you zoom it, you have this kind of thing. So it looks like pretty intermittent. OK, so that was, this is an old story. Well, old. Not that old, but. And if you look at the distribution of the energies of these spikes that you can see here, we obtain this power distribution of avalanche amplitude and energies. So this means that in this case, it seems that the fluctuation of plasticity are wide. Okay, so this is completely different to the classical assumption. So now we have, okay, and then after. After this work, many different people perform a numerical simulation with different kind of model, including Karen, and they confirm this kind of behavior and power law distribution of avalanche sizes. And then many different, well, first Demiduk and other, but also many other people later, perform similar experiment, but on micro and nano pillar. And they obtain this kind of stress strain curve, which looks very similar to the zinc test of R1 many years ago. Okay, but then they analyze the size of these strain avalanches and found also power distribution.
Just a quick question: so, when they measure avalanche distribution, at which stress are they doing this measure? The average on all stress?
No, that's stress strain, right?
Yeah, here is stress strain.
Yes.
But the loading mode, yeah, the loading mode is special. It's not fully stress control, not fully strain control. It's something. For me, it has been always been a bit strange. Maybe you can comment. I don't know because you know also this kind of test very well.
It's a strain difference between the two.
Yeah.
But you can do it either way. The scaling would be the same. Yeah.
So which range of stress are we?
You can see it there.
It's
also the red.
So here is, I don't want to comment that for now, but here is the stress strain curve you obtained for the bulk crystal, a big one. And here is that for the same material, this is nickel, what you obtain for micro and nano pillars of different size. So first, you can see that the yield stress is larger for the small
I think what he's asking is, if you look at different range of stress, intervals of stress, you find the same statistics for avalanches.
The yield stress, you cannot prescribe the yield stress, no? Maybe I do not understand you.
No, I think
sorry.
Close to the yield stress, far from the yield stress.
Oh.
Stationarity of your avalanche.
That bottom part.
You get a curve that grows as you approach the yield stress, and you can do scaling collapse.
Karen published a paper on that.
But this particular plot is just averaging over everything at all stress levels.
Yeah, right? This one, yes. The first one from Demiduk, it was over all the. The deformation curve. And then Karen published something more detailed about, if you are more or less far from the yield point and so on. But I will not discuss that so much, this point specifically today, okay? But yeah.
Just because the Karen was talking about avalanches that are system spanning even below the yield stress. So not like the cutoff with diver that you approach the yield stress, but even below the yield stress. There's some paper on that, so I just wondering
okay. So for today, the question I would like to ask if these two visions of plasticity compatible, if we have this classical view of mild fluctuation or something more related to wide fluctuation. actually, I will show that they can be compatible, at least in some materials. Okay. Okay, so to do that, because I will present experiment, I have to explain a little bit more of what we measure when we put our acoustic transducer. So here is a very old plot, well, in the 70s. Acoustic emission recorded during the plastic deformation of aluminum under tension. And what you see here is that the signal can be, you have first what they call continuous acoustic emission, which is in fact the background noise, but this background noise can change during deformation. So you have some information contained in it. And then superposed to this background noise, you have discrete burst like that we can call crackling noise, okay? And in the early days, most of the people essentially focused on the evolution of the background noise through deformation or for different samples and so on and so forth. And they didn't pay too much attention to this burst, okay? And also, the problem is that with acoustic emission, classical systems which are running nowadays, they can detect automatically burst of activity when your signal goes above some predefined threshold. And then the system estimates the maximum amplitude of the signal, the energy related to that. This is automatically done. So this is the first part of information you have, the one I showed before for ice samples. But then you can also record this continuous acoustic emission, but generally you can only do that at a frequency which is relatively low, let's say at maximum 100 hertz, something like that. So you average the acoustic power over a time window which is rather large, and you can include some peaks, some spike. Okay. And very recently, now we are able, at least for some period of time, to record the full signal, like seismologists do with their signal. But the problem, seismologists, they can record the full signal at 1 hertz or 10 hertz. But in our case, we have to record it at 5 megahertz. So you can imagine that we cannot do that for all the tests. We can only do that for some period of time and look at the property of the full signal itself. So this is relatively new now. Systems can allow that. Okay, so this is a kind of acoustic emission burst you can have, just defining what we call the maximum amplitude, which generally is very close to the beginning of the signal because the rise time is very short, and then it declines in average. So you can define the duration, which is the time over which the signal is above your predefined threshold. And then the energy of the burst is just the integral of the square of the amplitude over the duration of the signal. So these are the three main parameters that the system automatically detects. And so you can look at statistics on that and so on. So then if you want to interpret this data, you need a source model, like, for example, for earthquakes, you need a source model too. So I used a source model developed in the 80s in Lyon by Ruby and co-workers, where you can relate the instantaneous amplitude to actually this kind of local strain rate. So it's related to the number of dislocations which are involved in the avalanche at time t, times their length, times their velocity. And also, you have the Burgers vector here. So you have a kind of relationship between the instantaneous amplitude and a kind of local strain rate, OK? But the problem now, you want to know what amount of strain corresponds to one event like this one. So you have to integrate something, you have to integrate A over all the duration of the burst. And so to do that, we used a decay hypothesis like that. So it means that it's if you when you start the avalanche and then you have friction because of phonon interaction, for example, and so on. So it decays like that, and then you can integrate. And in this case, the good point is that you can directly relate the maximum amplitude that you see that your system is giving you to the amount of strain which has been dissipated by the avalanche. And to check if this is correct, you can compare the scaling between the maximum amplitude and the energy, because the energy itself, which is measured by the system, is an integral of the amplitude to the square. Okay, so you should have this kind of scaling. And okay, it seems to work. So the point here is that in case of what I call discrete acoustic emission, the energy of the burst scale as the square of the plastic strain associated to this avalanche.
This cannot be checked with a mechanical measurement of the strain?
Yeah.
This can be checked?
It has been checked, actually, my very first paper on ice. Okay. We did several loading steps at different stress. So we obtain different strain rate. And if you average, or if you accumulate the strain, the amplitude of all the bursts you record during one time window, it scales with the strain measured by the extensometer and so on. So it works. Now, so that was for discrete acoustic emission. Now I come back to what I call continuous acoustic emission, so the evolution of the background noise. So this time you need another model to explain your data, another source model. And in this case, the fundamental assumption is that your acoustic power is the sum of numerous small and uncorrelated motion. Okay, so in fact, mild fluctuation. So it's completely different to the assumption associated to discrete acoustic emission, which is you have it's related to dislocation avalanches. This time, dislocation are moving, but completely independently at the same times on different places in the crystals. And so in this case, energies instead of amplitude should add up. So this would mean that your acoustic power should scale as the plastic strain rate this time, and not to the square of the plastic strain rate. So this kind of relationship you can also check directly from the experiment. And I will come back on this later. So now I have this different piece of information, continuous acoustic emission, discrete acoustic emission, and so on and so forth. So I look at different materials, ice, cadmium, which is also hexagonal, copper, which is FCC, so it's much more isotropic in terms of plasticity, and aluminum. And in this case, we used cyclic loading, so tension compression loading on the samples. So in red, I have just plotted the acoustic power through time. And so in this case, you see again that the signal is strongly intermittent, and you cannot even detect the background, so small compared to the burst of activity. This is quite similar in case of cadmium, but in case of copper, it's different. The response seems much smoother, and especially your continuous emission is maximum at the macroscopic plastic yield, and then decrease slowly during true deformation. And sometimes you have peaks of activities, but very few. Okay. Here, the same for aluminum. The response is quite smooth. You have also maximum at each plastic yield, and you have symmetry between tension and compression. So it means that it is indeed related to plasticity, because if it would be related to microcracking, for example, you would be dissymmetric in tension and compression. So it's quite smooth, but then sometimes you have peaks. Very few, once again. So what you can do is just to calculate the amount of acoustic power that correspond to the peaks that you are able to detect. Okay, in order to quantify the degree of intermittency, I would say, or of wildness. So in case of ice, it's almost 100%. So all the acoustic power is just acoustic burst. Cadmium, it's almost the same. Copper, it's much less. And in case of cyclic loading of aluminum, it's a very small number. So you have some burst of activities, but as you can see, you have some cycle where you have no burst. So it seems that you have a big difference between hexagonal structure and metals which are FCC, okay, fast 700 cubic.
Structural, is it type of bonding, actually? I mean, you have metallic bonding here, and you have
many
different type of bonding in ice and cadmium, right?
Well, our point is that this is more related to the structure of the crystal. It's hexagonal, so as I will explain later, it means that most of plastic deformation occur to a single plane, okay? It's dense.
HCP metal would do the same as ice and cadmium.
Yeah, zinc do the same as. So I don't think it's the nature of the bonding. No, it's more the crystallography. At least for the things. So now the question is. Is this continuous acoustic emission really the signature of mild fluctuation? Because we could argue, okay, just because you show an evolution of the background, it's maybe you have a lot of small avalanches which are hidden below your detection threshold, which is somehow arbitrary. So you have to test that. So the first point is that, as I explained before, in case of continuous acoustic emission, you should have the acoustic power scaling as a strain rate. So we can test that, for example, on cyclic loading of aluminum. So here it is for a strain control test. Here is for a stress control test. So the red curve is the acoustic power, and the dotted line is the strain that you measure with the extensometer. And I think the agreement is quite good. So it seems that at least this model is okay. And then you can also record the full signal at 5 megahertz, and you look at its properties. And one thing you can do is to, so this is this kind of signal, and you look at the distribution of minima and maxima of the signal, and it's really a Gaussian distribution, okay? From more sophisticated multifractal analysis, you can check that there is no intermittency hidden in this signal. Okay, so all of this means that you have really like something Gaussian noise. Okay, but this Gaussian noise is changing through deformation. Okay, so there is some information. It's not just the experimental noise of the machine or whatever, the recording system. And now if you still look at aluminum, but this time you look at the very first cycle of loading. So I don't know if you know very well the problem of cyclic deformation of metals, but when you start to load the system, you have not yet a microstructure in your metals. But then as you cycle, dislocation move in different slip planes. They get more and more intricate, and they will form what we call dislocation cells. So you get a very well-defined microstructure. And so here it's the second cycle. So it means that the microstructure is not yet formed. Okay. So the mean free pass for dislocation is still very large. And so you see a smooth response, which is in agreement with the strain measurement of the extensometer. But in this case, you have quite a lot of peaks. So you indeed have the coexistence of mild and wild fluctuation. So here is the result of the mild fluctuation, and here is the wild fluctuation. Okay, so
yeah.
Aluminum. Because we have only cyclic test, we only did that on aluminum. So, and so now you can look. Okay, so in any case, including in aluminum, we have also this burst. So we can look at the distribution of this burst. And in all cases, for this wild fluctuation, you have power law distribution. So the big difference in ice is that in case of ice or cadmium, these avalanches represent almost all the activity, plastic activity. In this case, it's just a tiny percentage of the plastic deformation. But in all cases, this fluctuation, wild fluctuation, are power law distributed. Okay? But now we obtain something which was not expected, actually, at the beginning. I didn't expect that. It seems that when you look at all, when you look at many different tests on the different materials, it seems that the exponent of the distribution is not universal. It depends on the crystal symmetry. And generally, you have smaller exponent for when you have, like in ice, when the intermittency of the signal is the strongest. And the exponent increases as you are going towards materials where the mild part of the deformation is larger. Okay. So that was unexpected. And then I will try to explain how how we try to interpret that. So just to conclude on the experiment and how we see that in terms of, well, in a very qualitative way. So as I showed, in case of hexagonal materials, we have essentially a crackling plasticity. And we believe that it is related to the fact that in this case, you have a very anisotropic glide. So essentially, all the dislocation move on one single slip plane. And so this means that the dynamics of the assembly of dislocation is essentially ruled by long-range elastic interaction. This is different in case of FCC, because in this case, you have multi-slip. Dislocation can move in many directions. So dislocation in one plane can play the role of a forest of obstacle for the other dislocation. You will have a lot of short-range interaction, like dislocation junction and so on. And because of this, you form patterns of dislocation. So this is, for example, what you get when you cycle. You have cyclic deformation in copper, but you would have exactly the same kind of thing in aluminum, for example. So you will develop this kind of microstructure. And actually, in the metallurgical literature, people think that when you have such kind of microstructure and you want to plastify the material, you generate this individual dislocation on the walls of the cells, and then this dislocation move through the cell, and you will have this on many different cells, but in a completely independent way. Okay? So the so it would mean that it is you have a lot of small uncorrelated motion. Okay. So that this kind of picture seems in agreement with the continuous emission that we can obtain, but it's not in agreement with the fact that even in this material, sometimes you have avalanches. Okay? So our interpretation is that from time to time, even when you have this kind of structure, it's not completely frozen, and you can have a very big rearrangement of the structure.
You don't show us any picture to have an idea of the spatial structure of on the imagine one plane, one smooth plane, and some kind of...
Maybe, at least for ice, it's not possible to have this kind of observation. But for sure, you...
A limit number of planes or things are sliding. That's
but for sure, you are not forming this kind of patterns. That's for sure. Because the nature of the interaction are really different. And I think, actually, we believe that this difference explains why you have mild versus wide fluctuations. So now we try to explain this observation from a very simple model. And this model first was inspired by evolution equation of dislocation density. So this kind of model have been developed for many years by people in metallurgy. there are many variants of this kind of models where you can include specific hardening or whatever you like. Here we start from something very, very simple. So this is, we try to follow the evolution of the density of mobile dislocation. We care only about mobile dislocation. We don't care about the dislocation which are not moving in our material. And we first start from a deterministic equation where here we have one term which is a nucleation rate and one term which is multiplication or annihilation rate. So you have to multiply this term by the density of dislocation because this means that you will create more dislocation if you have dislocation interacting between themselves. Okay, you have so forest dislocation can serve as pinning point to the dislocation moving in one plane and so on. Or if you have two dislocation of opposite side sign going together, they can annihilate. And here, our controlling parameter is the shear strain. Okay. So in this, with this very simple equation, you will go towards an equilibrium density, which is this one. Okay. So that's our starting point. Then we can add a stochastic term, where D here would be a kind of effective temperature, and xi is a internal noise of zero mean, okay? But if you add this external noise, you will have only Gaussian fluctuation, okay? And this is not what we observe. So what we did here is to introduce multiplicative noise. So we multiply the stochastic term by the dislocation density itself. And what does it mean? It means that the dislocation react collectively to perturbation. So if you have some place, a very large density of dislocation, and you have some external perturbation, they will react collectively. And so you could have an avalanche. So we have this equation. And this equation will give you the PDF, the distribution of the local density of mobile dislocation, which has this form here. And the good thing is that we have, first we have a power tail, which is here, but at small scales, you have Gaussian-like distribution. So this equation allows you to explain the coexistence between small stuff at small scales and power law tails for some events. Okay? And what we see also here is that the exponent here is no more completely universal. It will depend on the ratio between the multiplication annihilation term and this effective temperature term. Okay. So now we can try to relate this to experiment. So the exponent from the model writes like this, and we can directly relate this to the exponent we get for the amplitude of the acoustic emission, which measure the distribution of strain related to the avalanche. And then, because we have this scaling between the amplitude and the energy, we can relate our exponent of the model with the exponent of the energies, for example. And the conclusion is that for, if you remember, we obtain experimental exponents which were larger for aluminum and smaller for ice. And so this means that this term is smaller for ice compared to aluminum. Okay, here is just if you run this model numerically just to show the structure. So if you put a very large C over D ratio, you will get only constant fluctuation without any kind of burst, okay? So something boring. And if now this term becomes much smaller, the wild fluctuation will start to dominate, and which this looks like a bit this what we record during the deformation of ice. Okay. And then to finish, this is my last slide, which is not based on our measurement, but just a discussion about which is observed in micro and nano pillar, because we think that maybe this kind of conceptual framework might be also used to understand some of this result, and especially the fact that if you as I said in all my talk, is that for FCC bulk material like aluminum, copper, the response is essentially mild, okay? And in fact, if you look at micro pillar, here I think it might be nickel or I can't remember exactly. You have stress strain curves, which is rather smooth. But as you decrease the size of the pillar, the response looks more and more intermittent and wild. Okay, so you have also a size effect. Okay, so meaning that smaller is wilder. And we believe that this might be possibly related to the fact that in case of nanopillar, because you have so few dislocations within the pillar, you cannot have the mechanics you have in bulk materials, because you only have single slip. Even for, as you can see, actually, you see, this looks very like the deformation of a nice single crystals, but this is a FCC material here, and so here all the argument I used before to say that you can have a strong importance of short range interaction and so on in case of FCC, it is no longer true at these small scales, and so in this case you should get something similar to ice, and it seems that this is indeed the case, as I showed at the very beginning. So I will conclude on that, and thank you.
And this, just one comment, and this is because probably, basically, in this case, these samples are you know, you showed these patterns before, and you showed they had a diameter of 1 micron, and so now you're getting into sizes that are so small that they're, you know, smaller than these pattern sizes, right? That's basically that.
Exactly.
Yeah, very nice.
You cannot form these kind of patterns.
Yeah, exactly.
In just such a small.
So to come back to the comment I made earlier, so in the yielding transition problem, amorphous solids, we find that there is not your exponent theta that characterizes the number of locations that are about to yield, and it enters into scaling relation with the exponent tau. So something I didn't have to discuss, but that we've done with Marcus, if he's still here, is that. For some system preparation, once you have a non-trivial exponent theta, you expect to have system spanning avalanches even below the yield stress. That's a non-trivial prediction. Now, Stefano was seeing this system spanning avalanche below the yield stress in his numeric, so we discussed with him this week, and he checked that he had a theta, and indeed he found a theta that matches our prediction in terms of exponent for the avalanches below the yield stress. So my question is, in your experiment, is there a convincing evidence that really you don't have system spanning avalanches before you reach some kind of yield stress? And do you have convincing evidence that instead it's like beginning, that you have a cutoff that actually seems to diverge as you reach some characteristic yield stress?
So for my experiment on big samples and so on, I never looked at that. For example, if you take the case of ice, nobody knows what is the yield stress of ice. So even if you put a very, very small load, I mean, we are currently trying to do that, but it's, I mean, experimentally it's very difficult. It starts to deform, to creep, okay? So I cannot answer to that. Now for,
maybe it's a way to say that you don't see some growing cutoff.
Yeah. Now for micropillar, Karin wrote a paper saying that the cutoff is diverging at the yield stress. Maybe,
yeah,
it's better if you answer.
Yeah, so there's basically two cases. There's a case where you don't have hardening in the very small pillars, the nanopillars, and you see actually you can see it from the stress strain curve as you approach yielding, it becomes flatter, so the slips clearly can get bigger, and so we bend them in stress, you can do scale collect. That's for nanopillars. But for the micro and larger, you get the hardening. And the hardening sort of makes your system operate near the critical point, so to speak. And that's why you get these very large regions where you get the same avalanche statistics of a large range. So it's a question.
So there's another interpretation of what means hardening. That's what I want to say. That we also seen the elastoplastic models, which do not have this kind of hardening.
Okay.
It's a broad range. And it has to do with the fact that there's a singularity in the number of sides that are about to yield. Because the argument I gave about stability is the very same interaction kernel in this case. You would expect, too, that stability is a stringent constant. You get as long for a low elastic interaction.
Once again, all the distribution I've shown in ice, on copper, or whatever, this is for acoustic bursts recorded after yield stress, macroscopic yield stress. So for ice, it's obvious because, I mean, as I said before, I do not have a detectable yield stress, and it just creep. So I can deform over days, and you always have the same distribution. Okay, so this is something different. So I can, for my experiment, and I cannot answer to your question, but and there is also a debate, but essentially from numerical, also numerical and theoretical studies on this point, but voilà.
Water is a fantastic liquid, right? So very difficult also, but ice is also very different structures. You can make amorphous ice of different types.
But only under very high pressure, and so only then. So, of course, here it's only for ice 1H, which is a classical structure.
Have you ever tried amorphous ice to get distribution in there for you?
No, because just to get it experimentally, it's completely unstable. It's unstable on classical pressure. So. I mean, to perform the experiment, it's quite difficult. So, no, it's just for classical ice. This problem might be actually, it's debated for ice on Europa, for example. satellite of Saturn, where you there might be an ice crust several tens of kilometers or even hundreds of kilometers thick, and so you may have so strong pressure, so you could have other kind of ice, and the deformation of ice, plastic deformation of ice, could be important for the all the dynamics of the planet, and so they are trying to. But I mean, there is no experimental information about plastic deformation of ice instead for ice 1H. Nothing tried to do that. It's so. So
well, it's because they have these all this discussion about liquid phase transitions in water. Also, named is discussing that now. So different for amorphous ice.
Yeah.
You know, phases. So that might be.
I know there are. Yeah. But I think it would be very, very difficult. Yeah.
So I'm intrigued by this change of exponent that you show going from HCP to the FCC systems. You had this one slide where you had these four different systems, and you had a picture of the copper aluminum with the grain boundary with the micro patterns. Yeah, this one, the one afterward where you can see. So I guess my question is, do we understand? So you made this point that okay, you have more slip systems in the FCC system, okay?
Yeah.
And but then you also emphasize on this patterning, which I think is in the next slide, where you have these grain boundary structures. So I guess I'm wondering, do we know how much of that change in behavior is due to the fact that you have more slip systems versus activity at the grain boundaries themselves, like grain boundary sliding or processes in the grain boundary? Any idea about that? How do we get to
here? It's not exactly grain boundaries, it's cells boundaries.
Yeah,
okay?
Exactly.
So now it's different. Because I performed, it was several years ago, I also did some experiment on ice polycrystals. This time, but with real grain boundaries.
I see.
And what we observed is that the distribution of avalanches was cut off because of the grain size.
Oh, then just the size cut off. Okay.
And here, at least for aluminum and or copper and so on, you do not see, at least from the data, you do not see an upper cut off. So this means that you can really, this structure is not frozen, okay? You can just reorganize it sometimes. It's quite rare, but it can happen. So it's not like crystals, you know? Because crystal, to change the crystals, it's like recrystallization and so on, it's different.
Yeah, I was wondering what activities, what contribution to the plastic response would come, but maybe this is different from the polycrystalline. So you would say that most of the effect going from 1.42 is from the fact that you have multiple subsystems.
Yeah, and so this is expressed in our model through the parameter which is related to multiplication. So
okay.
In case of
okay.
Multiple system, you have a stronger multiplication effect. It's an explanation.
I'm just curious.
Thank you again for the question.